So it's a pleasure and it's an honor to have here with us Professor Larissa Katz, who is professor and Canada Research Chair in Private Law Theory at the Faculty of Law of the University of Toronto in Canada. And she will present a paper entitled Standing and Private Law Methodology. So, Larissa Katz, the floor is yours.
Well, thank you so much, and thank you, Diego. Thank you to the University of Girona for having me here. It's wonderful to be a part of this initiative. The study of private law is in itself a wonderful thing, but the philosophy of private law is even that much better. So the paper that I would like to present today is in progress, and it builds off earlier work of mine, which is a paper you have before you. Which is a paper I co-authored with Matthew Shapiro at Rutgers University. And the paper concerns this concept of standing in law. Now, concepts are important in law, they're important in the philosophy of law, and they make sense of our legal practices in ways that can be very illuminating of the underlying philosophical questions. So there's really two ways to think about law and philosophy. So one way, of course, is to think about philosophical problems that we work out in our moral theories and our theories about law, and then perhaps to find expression of those theories in the law that we have. So that is where I think the philosophers are just, in a sense, working out their preferred moral theories and then finding an expression of those in legal doctrine. And there's a second way in which one might think about law and philosophy, and that is to look at law as in itself a repository of values and of philosophically significant questions and problems to solve, and that law itself is the locus for philosophical thinking, that through law, through legal study, we come to see how it is that we resolve problems related to our interactions together in time and space. And so the philosophy of private law, in the hands of some philosophers, some theorists, works this way, that there is a kind of in-depth study of legal doctrine. Through this in-depth study of legal doctrine, the philosopher of private law comes to understand more about how we shape our interactions, about the values that those rules serve, and about the important moral problems that the law in itself generates, the kind of downstream problems, one might say, of the law solving other problems. And so this is the kind of work that I think I'm engaged in, is more the latter kind, where I look to law as itself a source of moral ideas, a source of moral thinking. And this has, of course, had me labeled a common law fetishist by many, the idea that one looks to the common law as something philosophically significant in itself, worked out over hundreds and hundreds of years, not perfect, of course, not a pure theory of law by any means, but yet something which offers a very good starting place to think about the available tools for shaping human relations. And so the concept of standing is one of these really important legal ideas that I think has deep, deep moral significance. And I think we should begin by thinking about what is the concept of standing in law, what does it all mean? And standing, I would say just generally, is what makes a question a matter for you to decide. So a person who lacks standing lacks the authorization to decide a question that is of some concern to others. So in private law, the idea of standing connects substantive and procedural rights. So the question of whether to enforce another's duty, or the question of what can be done with a thing and by whom, are assigned to the person with the standing to resolve those questions. So my standing to sue, to bring an action in a court, it's a constitutive element of my authority to enforce my rights in private law. My standing to decide whether you enter my home as my guest, what Avihai has described as your standing to say so as an owner, reflects the authority of an owner to determine the normative quality of another's entering the bounds of her property. So, of course, if an owner decides to withhold permission, another enters, only as a trespasser that describes the normative quality of the entry. But if an owner grants permission, the other enters as a licensee, again, determining the normative quality of the entering. So the standing to be the one who determines the normative quality of another's position vis-a-vis that land or vis-a-vis that thing, that's a kind of standing too. So the first kind of standing I described, we have in the form of a right to bring an action in court. That's a procedural right. The second kind of standing we have in the form of a property right. That's a substantive right in private law. And so what connects both kinds of standing is that some matter of concern to others is made your question to resolve to the exclusion of others. So notice that standing in law comes before expertise. So if you have the standing to resolve a question, whether to enforce your rights, whether to grant or refuse someone permission to enter, then it is a matter for you to decide, and no one else can usurp your authority to resolve that question, even if that other person has more knowledge, more experience in the matter, or is somehow personally better suited to give a better answer to the question, all things considered. So the idea of standing comes before expertise, making it a question for a particular person to decide to the exclusion of others. So this generally is what we mean by standing in law. And in this talk, I'm going to take up two related questions about standing. So the first question is what justifies standing, in particular, the standing to enforce one's rights. So that's the procedural kind of standing. What justifies that? Does one own one's own conflict for reasons personal to us? Do we have a special moral claim to be the enforcer of our own rights? Or do we come to acquire the standing to bring an action in court like we come to acquire ownership as an office? Largely, on my account anyway, of ownership for institutional reasons. So this first question I'm going to set against the background of the paper you read, which deals with John Gardner's view of the plaintiff as an institutional actor and his view that any moral claim to be the one who enforces your own rights is actually just a legal fallacy. We're bringing from law into the moral realm a sense that these are our rights, that we own them like we own our car or our house, which for John, of course, means something we have for personal reasons, reasons personal to us. His view of ownership being a moral view, not the kind of institutional account that I myself am more comfortable with. Okay, so that's the first question. What justifies our standing to enforce? Okay, there's a second question that I'm going to take up in this talk. To what extent does the idea of standing inform what counts as a private law right at all? So to what extent does this idea of standing, the idea that there's some question for you to decide, to what extent does that idea of standing tell us what counts as a legal right and what doesn't? Does what count as a legal right, a right for the purposes of law, depend on standing in some deep sense, that one doesn't have a right at all if one doesn't have the standing to resolve some matter of concern to others too? Okay, so we're going to see on the second question that for many private law theorists, and certainly in the formalist tradition, the neo-Kantian tradition, the idea of standing is a filter on what counts as a private right at all. And Avihai, I will include you in this group because, of course, your account of ownership explicitly connects it to standing. But I would say that for the Kantians and Arthur Ripstein and others down the hall from me in Toronto, the idea of standing connects both substantive and procedural rights. All rights are a matter of standing for the Kantian. Now, not all private law theorists think this way. John Gardner doesn't, or didn't, of course. And that's something I will talk about in the paper. When I deal with the second question, we're going to see that for people like John, while standing might explain your primary and secondary rights, your tertiary rights, your rights to sue to enforce those rights, it doesn't tell us, anything special about the private rights you have. The idea of standing for John as a tertiary doesn't adhere in the very idea of a private right as it does for Arthur Ripstein and for many others. So the idea of standing as a filter on what counts as a right at all, I'm going to argue in my paper, the paper you haven't seen, but which I hope will be available and circulated in due course after this talk, the idea of standing as a filter on what counts as a right, I think, is a really powerful idea, right? This idea that there's some question that is reserved to you to decide to the exclusion of others. But it meets a really powerful challenge in the form of what Kant himself called ambiguous rights. These are rights without coercion. And there was another case of ambiguous right for Kant, which is coercion without right. So for Kant, coercion without right was necessity. But right without coercion, the case that Kant himself pointed to without much discussion, actually, was equity and equitable rights. So Kant had clearly been made aware of this weird thing in common law systems called equity, and clearly had been told by someone who no doubt visited him for lunch in Königsberg that there was this thing called equity in England and there were these equitable rights, but they didn't really come with the same authorization to compel others. That there was, in a sense, some kind of element of coercion missing as Kant understood it. Now, Kant got a lot wrong about the nature of equity. He clearly was learning about it secondhand from some visiting Anglo-Saxon lawyer. But one thing that I think he did get right is that there is something missing in equitable rights that we have in legal rights. The ordinary private law rights set down in the common law. And that is the idea of standing, the idea that there's some special authorization that you, the right holder, has in virtue of being a right holder with respect to the subject matter of the rights. So the idea of standing does not figure in equitable rights, nor in individualized public rights, I will argue, as it does in other private law rights. This, in my view, raises at least an interesting set of questions, if not a challenge, for the idea of standing as a filter on what counts as a right at all for the purposes of law. Okay, so there's two questions in. The first question we'll see is what justifies standing to enforce your rights, right? And then the second question is, does the idea of standing count as a filter for what we will recognize as a right at all for the purposes of law? How then do we accommodate things like equitable rights? That's that second set of questions. So I hope that I'll have time to kind of make my way through both. I'm going to start with the first. Okay, and so this is what justifies the standing to sue. And hopefully we can learn something about the nature of standing when we study what justifies, what kinds of reasons are sufficient to account for the standing to enforce your own legal rights. And whether that tells us anything about the nature of standing then as it figures in private law more generally. Okay, so justifying your standing to sue. I mean, I suppose that many of us don't really think about that. I mean, isn't it pretty obvious that if it's your right, you get to be the one who enforces it? That seems fairly intuitive and straightforward. What business is of it is of anyone else to enforce my rights if I don't want to, right? And what business is it of anyone else to tell me not to enforce my rights if I do want to? It seems obvious that I should be the one to do that. Indeed, this is what Kant thought. Just in virtue of having a right, you have the authorization to compel another to perform their obligations to you. So for Kant, right and the authorization to use coercion mean one and the same thing. A right just is the authorization to use coercion. So underpinning the idea of right and the authorization to coerce is the Kantian idea of freedom, of course, freedom from domination by others. And this idea, as we've already seen, fits our morally intuitive, you know, understanding of why we get to enforce our rights, right? It seems like it is a matter for me to decide whether to compel someone to perform obligations they owe just to me. So that's the kind of, I would almost say it's a standard view. It's certainly standard in my hall. But of course, we're going to see that there are dissenters, those who don't think that it is obviously the case that you are justified in enforcing your own rights, and only you are justified in enforcing your own rights. So for John, it's a deeply mistaken view to think that freedom, or autonomy, as he puts it, can justify the power to sue. He thinks that people who turn to autonomy-based reasons to justify the power a person has to sue to enforce their rights are actually slipping in two additional features of rights in this talk about rights and their violation, as though these simply follow from the nature of rights. But, of course, according to John, they don't. So the first conceptual supplement that John Gardner has read into these Kantian accounts is a hallmark of choice theory of rights. This is a view that a right entails the power to waive or to insist on enforcement, just baked into the idea of right. And he dismisses this as so much conceptual slippage. So John Gardner says, to have a right is to be in a position to exercise a power. To have a right is not to be in a position to exercise a power. It is simply to be in a position of being owed a duty. So being in a position to be owed a duty is not the same as being in a position to exercise a power. So you're just adding something more when you just claim the power to sue in virtue of having a right. And a second commonly held but mistaken view, according to John, is that what it is to have a right is to have a permission to make other people do their duty. Or the next best thing when we're talking about, you know, repair after a violation. So this view, at least John Gardner has argued, rests on what he called the legalistic fallacy. The legal norm, which of course confers such a permission on a person, is read back into the very idea of the moral right. But it doesn't follow from the existence of a right that there is such a permission to enforce, nor the power to conscript others or courts in that enforcement. More argument is needed for that. Now, just a note about John Gardner's view, because of course this is, John Gardner's view. John has written quite a lot over the years about the gap, right, between having a duty and someone else is having the power to compel you to do what morality requires of you. So John was very suspicious of things like punishment, for instance, right? Punishment following the violation of others' rights or the failure to discharge obligations. He thought punishment needed all the justificatory help it could get. He thinks, too, that the power to sue, to bring to bear all of the weight of the state's apparatus on someone else, needs all the help it can get. It doesn't follow just from having a right that you get that permission to make others do what morality requires. And this really connects nicely to John's view that moral reasoning remains ours, even as a legal system is there helping us to do what morality requires. Right? It doesn't put anyone in a position of power to coerce us. So why then, on John's view anyway, could there be this authorization to coerce or to compel others to do their duty? And why is John so concerned that there be such a justification? So let me take the last point first. Why is John so worried about this power to coerce? So again, not to get too deeply into John's work here, but I think it's interesting how he puts this, and I want to draw your attention to this. So on John's view, the right to sue when someone violates your legal rights, select some people for, quote, a measure of official support in their personal affairs that most other clients of the welfare state can only dream of. That's a quote. So the right to haul someone into court and to compel their performance of their duties to you, first of all, gives massive discretion to plaintiffs, and secondly, privileges plaintiffs with that kind of a right over other people whose rights give them no power to coercively enforce. Now, John doesn't get into this, but when I sit back and think about the kinds of rights some people have without that coercive power to enforce, what I think about is how people, for instance, without backyards, rely on individualized public rights to go to parks, but lack the standing to enforce others' duties to use those parks in a way consistent with their own use, absent special particularized damages suffered. So say, for example, someone blocks up the road or blocks up a park so I can't use it anymore. I suffer the loss of the use of that. I have no power, though, to enforce my right to use. Right? Just losing access to the park or the road doesn't give me the particularized damages, personally, that would entitle me to go into court. So I think this is the kind of thing that is motivating John here. Think how privileged we are when we have the entire state apparatus behind us enforcing our legal rights in private law, when other rights that are morally significant get no such additional support or help from the state in the form of the courts. Okay, so I find like that's a compelling enough reason to really think a little harder about what could justify the standing that we have to enforce our rights. If it doesn't just follow from the fact of having a right, well, what then could explain? Now, John gives institutional reasons, right? So in his view, plaintiffs contribute to the more systemic objectives of the legal process, the objective of doing justice under law when they bring a lawsuit. And so they play a role in the administration of justice and the maintenance of the rule of law. He also thought there were other institutional reasons that justify leaving the power to sue in the hands of private actors rather than have, for example, a public prosecutor who goes around enforcing your property rights for you, right? And so his view is an additional institutional reason for preferring plaintiffs is they diffuse public power to coerce, right? So we avoid unhealthy concentrations of power in the hands of officials by leaving it to plaintiffs to sue to enforce, to decide to sue and to control litigation going forward. Okay, so that is, I think, so far all I've said is the standing we have to sue, to decide a question, whether or not to enforce our rights, whether or not to coerce or to others or to compel others to perform, is a question for us as private actors. The legal system makes it so, but why? That requires justification. The Kantians would say, no, it doesn't. It just follows from having a right that, of course, you're the one who has the standing to decide whether or not to sue, right? And then you have the John Gardner view of, that doesn't follow. That's adding additional elements to this concept of right that need further justification. They don't just fall out of the concept of right by itself. All that a right gives you is in a position to be is a position to be owed a duty, right? It doesn't give you this other position of having power. All right, so that's where we are. John offers us institutional reasons that justify our legal order, the fact that plaintiffs do have the power to sue and there isn't actually a public prosecutor out there for the most part enforcing your property rights for you. And unless you live in New Zealand, there's not an accident insurance scheme that is taking over your tort claims either. But what's my view? Well, so my view is in part the view that is worked out here with Matt Shapiro, in part a view that I advanced in an earlier paper on the idea of estoppel, which is that the power to sue does put the plaintiff in an institutional position. As John himself thought, the plaintiff has a role continuous with the judge in a popularized, decentralized system for the administration of justice. But it seems to me that this institutional role that plaintiffs have is actually theirs, not just for institutional reasons, but also for reasons personal to them. So when John was resisting the Kantian, who thought that our power to sue was ours for reasons personal to us, he was mostly addressing people like Arthur Ripstein, who thought, well, freedom explains everything. That's all there is. It's just autonomy. But there's other reasons personal to you for why you might want to have, or ought to have, I should say, the power to sue. And so what are those reasons? Well, so Matt and I identified two in the paper that was circulated to you. So the first is the strong moral reasons that plaintiffs, that right holders have to control their own conflicts. And these are of two kinds. One is a dignity interest. So dignity in this context refers to something quite specific. It means an interest in not abasing oneself by letting rights violations go unanswered. That's a moral interest we have as a holder of those rights, right? A dignity interest, maybe Kant would call it, rightful honor, but an interest in non-self-abasement, right? Which happens where rights violations just stand. No one holds the duty ower to account. But secondly, there's a second, I think, category of reasons personal to us as right holders, which explain why I think the right holder does have a moral claim to be the one withstanding to enforce. And this is an interest that we have in not being a stickler for our rights. So stickler actually is a term from, well, the English translation of Aristotle. It's an equitable idea. This is the idea that we have moral reasons sometimes, not always to insist on our rights, not always to insist on the performance of a duty owed to us, and not being a stickler for our rights. Now, these are personal interests that we have, right? Why are they personal? These are personal interests because it reflects badly on us if we are sticklers, badly on our character, right? It reflects badly on us as persons, as moral agents, if we are sticklers for our rights, enforcing them to the letter. It also reflects badly on us if we stand down gratuitously in a regime in which rights enforcement is available, but we don't take it. We abase ourselves to others. Okay, so morality guides us in some contexts to stand on our rights, to enforce them because dignity requires it. Morality guides us to stand down and not to be sticklers in other contexts where morality requires it. So what I would say is that we as rights holders are morally on the hook for the manner in which decisions to enforce our rights are made. We have a personal interest in how the balance between being a stickler and self-abasing is made. Okay, these are moral reasons that make the decision to enforce and the manner of enforcement a matter of special personal concern for the right holder. And in my view, a view I share in the paper with Matt, this grounds a default presumption that the decision to enforce rights is a matter for the right holder, for the plaintiff. A presumption that can give way to institutional reasons that might sometimes justify other arrangements, where there is, in a sense, a public official in charge of enforcing rights or in charge of deciding when they can't be enforced. So just a couple of examples that emerge from the paper, examples where we might not want public prosecution of certain rights because we might wish it to be a matter for the right holder to decide not to enforce and not to be a stickler. I gave the example actually of a case that was in the news a while ago, the Birdwatcher case that at least one New Yorker in the room is going to know about. This was a case of somebody who was the victim of in effect, a racially motivated, I think it actually was a crime to call, it was a man who was a bird watcher who asked a woman to leash her dog. She didn't. Instead, she called the police and lied, saying that she had been threatened and intimidated by this person. Everything was exposed. Her racially motivated attack was exposed. And the fallout for her was significant. You know, she lost her job and there was all kinds of fallout. And the bird watcher was interviewed saying, look, I think what she did was really awful, but this is a systemic problem and I'm concerned about proportionality. A concern about proportionality is central to the idea of equity. And what the bird watcher was in effect saying is, you know, this is in my name that all of this is happening and I might have drawn the line somewhere else. And so that would be an example where there is a public prosecutor properly involved because in our legal system, there are certain kinds of rights that are left to the public officials to decide to enforce or not, right? But it's an example where you can see the moral interest that the person who suffered the violation has in deciding where the line is drawn. On the other hand, we know, and rape victims often are in this position, right, where you might have a regime where public prosecutors are in charge and let certain rights violations go unanswered, leading to a loss of dignity interests, I mean, and more, of course, beyond that, where a person is abased in a system in which their rights violations go unanswered, in which, you know, public officials might decide to allow just the violation to stand. And that would be an example where, actually, no, there's a strong moral interest on the part of the person whose rights were violated to have control over the proceedings, to decide the manner and the extent to which the rights violations are brought through the court system, the way in which her rights are enforced in that case. So we can see how it really is a matter personal to the rights holder, not necessarily for reasons of freedom or autonomy, but for these reasons that really come out of rightful honor in Kant, or reasons that come out of equity in Aristotle, for thinking about the manner of enforcement of your rights as a matter for you. So does this make our conflicts ours? Do we own our conflicts like we own our cars or our houses? So that's actually another story, right? So John Gardner wants to say we don't own our conflicts like we own our cars and our houses, because we own our conflicts for institutional reasons, but we own our cars and houses for personal reasons. But I guess in my own view, we also own our cars and houses for institutional reasons as, you know, in a kind of official, quasi-official role. Our ownership of things is a matter of, I think, institutional concern. An office we come to hold where we meet the procedures for appointment to that office. I don't have any natural personal moral claim to own my house. I have come to acquire my house and to be in a position to set the agenda for that house for institutional reasons, because and only because I've satisfied the criteria for appointment to that position. Now, that's not to say there can't be reasons personal to us to come to own things, detrimental reliance, proprietary estoppel. Note, in the common law, all equity does ground reasons personal to us to become an owner of something, but that's the exception, not the rule. Whereas I think for most powers to sue or rights to sue that we would think of as ours, we rely on that default presumption that they're ours for reasons personal to us, and they're taken out of our hands where there are institutional reasons that justify rebutting that presumption. Okay, so that, how am I doing for time?
Yeah, fine. You still have 15 minutes.
Okay, perfect. Good, because now I'm going to question two. All right, so that was the first question. How do we justify our standing to sue? What does it tell us about standing that is justified for, presumptively justified for reasons personal to us, but then has this institutional element? And does it help us in figuring out the role of standing in the philosophy of private law, where it's often used as a filter for what counts as a right at all? So as we've already seen, I think if you deprive standing of a moral justification all the way down, then you can see that it doesn't necessarily inhere in the idea of a right. That you can have a right, but perhaps not have the standing to enforce it. It's a standing that is presumptively yours, but may not be, right? So one can have rights that the state enforces, and that doesn't make it any less of a right, right? That it still is the grounding of another's obligation to you that is cognizable in law, that the state can enforce through legal mechanisms like courts, and it still is a right that you have. So perhaps it does, I think, shed some doubt on whether the Kantian approach, as philosophically attractive as it is, necessarily gets at the philosophical nature of standing in law, right, which has its own, I think, normative foundations that may not fit perfectly within our preferred philosophical theories. But there's another reason why I want to kind of push back and ask some questions now about the idea of standing as a filter on what counts as a right. And that is to meet the Kantians on their own terms and to think about the nature of equity and equitable rights. So equity raises a powerful challenge to an account of private law rights as the authorization to coercively enforce the obligations of others. So we've seen that the authorization to compel another to perform her duty grounds the power that we have to exercise self-help, right? An owner is coercively enforcing her right where she exercises self-help by, you know, removing, you know, a trespasser or abating a nuisance, for instance. Exercises of self-defense, for instance, are exercises of self-help. And they can be justified on the basis of I have a right, and therefore I have this authorization to coerce. So my husband, Malcolm Thorburn, actually writes about criminal law, and he has this whole account of justifications and self-defense where he explains that there is this kind of authorization to exercise legitimate coercion to resist a rights violation sort of within the legal order, stepping down only to a police officer or public official if they are present and available. And so there's a way in which we can explain self-help as consistent with this overall picture of coercive enforcement of rights. Now, of course, enforcement through the courts is just another way of coercively enforcing the rights that you have for the Kantian. So equity challenges this because actually the nature of equitable rights is such that equity and equitable rights remain always a matter for courts of equity and are never questions that are given to the equitable rights holder to resolve. So let's talk first about equity and what that means. So you may all be familiar with the idea of equity from Aristotle, the idea of equity as justice in the particular case. And certainly there is an element of that understanding of equity in our common law understanding of equity. But in the common law, equity means something, I think, a little bit more precise and narrower than just equity as justice in the particular case. Equitable rights can be understood as supplements to legal rights within our common law system. They are always rights with respect to the legal rights that others have. They are rights that concern the way in which other people exercise their legal rights, and on my account, concern the integrity of the Rechtsstaat, the system of right, and ensure that the system of right does not depart too much from its aim, from its primary aim, which is justice. And so as rights that connect up to and control the way in which others exercise their legal rights, equitable rights fundamentally engage the way in which courts enforce those primary legal rights. So let me just give you an example. Let's take the trust. So a trust is a common law thing. Well, when I say a common law thing, I mean it's something that we find in common law jurisdictions. It's actually an equitable thing, right? And a trust is a right that a legal owner, call her the trustee, exercise her ownership powers in the best interests of the person we call the beneficiary. So it amounts to a right that this beneficiary has as against the legal owner, obligating the legal owner to exercise her ownership powers in the best interests of that beneficiary, obligating that legal owner to perform the terms of the trust. So it's what we might say an in personam right that attaches to the person with the in rem right. It's a right as against a particular other that she exercise her ownership powers in a particular way. Okay, so when we think about that, equitable rights, and all equitable rights have this connection to a legal right in this way. When we think about it this way, all that equitable rights are is rights that the court constrain a legal rights holder to engage with her rights in a certain way, where her legal rights are, of course, within the power of the courts to control. So equitable rights do not allow for self-help. So the beneficiary of a trust over, say, land, where the trust over land is just this personal obligation imposed on the legal owner of the land to exercise her position in the best interest of the beneficiary, to collect all rents for the benefit of the beneficiary, to manage the asset for the benefit of the beneficiary. There's no self-help possible there. The beneficiary cannot go and start collecting rents, right? Saying, well, look, I'm beneficially entitled. They have no power to go collect rents directly. They have no power to sue trespassers to keep them out. They have no power to go onto the land and set a different agenda for it, say one that, you know, brings in more income. They just sit back and they have to wait. They're entitled to the trustee's performance, right? But they have no power themselves to make it so, make it that the trustee does what the trustee has to do. So who has that power? Well, the courts, right? So when courts are doing equity in this system that Kant was so intrigued by, the courts are managing and supervising those who bear equitable burdens. Okay, so the courts have inherent discretion over the question of what equity requires of that legal owner. So this is why in common law systems it's always said that equitable remedies are all inherently discretionary. right? The whole development of equity is premised on this idea that courts of equity have inherent discretion to do equity, which is why equitable remedies that might be familiar to you, specific performance, injunctions, historically, before they became legislated, declaratory judgments. And the most important equitable remedy of all, account, right? Which is a remedy that is specifically designed to specifically enforce accounting relationships, so relationships between two parties where one has to account to the other for her dealings with some asset. Historically, the remedy of account developed in public law, right, to deal with the sheriff of the king who had to account to the king for all of his dealings with the king's property. But the courts of equity extended this public remedy to the private domain, holding trustees to account to the beneficiary for all of her dealings with the asset, where the stance, the posture of a court of equity, the supervisory managerial role, was to stand back and look at what the trustee had done, and then to falsify the accounts if, as it turns out, equity would have that trustee do otherwise than she actually did. So say the trustee, without authorization, dispersed money from the trust account, or without performing her trust duty, failed to receive money in, courts of equity falsified the account to make it as though the trustee had done what equity would have her do all along, and then just to hold the trustee personally liable to make up the shortfall. So this doctrinal picture contains some deep normative insights. So what are those? Well, the idea that there's this whole category of right that Kant labeled ambiguous right, that is ambiguous precisely because there's no built-in or inherent authorization to compel any other to perform that that obligation. There's just the ability to petition, to beg the court of equity, please exercise your discretion over this matter. The matter being a matter just for the courts, for public officials only, right? Please exercise your discretion to require this person to do as equity would have him do, if he's a trustee or if he's a bearer of any equitable obligation. So Kant put it this way, this is a quote, this is, by the way, from Vigilantius, who was a student of Kant's, who wrote lecture notes. Equity is in itself a genuine right, but has no right of coercion coupled with it. Owing to a want of imputation, the condition of coercion is not encountered there. So the want of imputation is actually a very, in itself, you know, interesting kind of term that I explain more in the paper, but what this amounts to is the particulars of what is required by another to give effect to an equitable right is lacking in the very nature of equitable rights. The nature of equitable rights is such that they are, in a sense, indeterminate. They require courts of equity who have standing to take up this question of what does equity require here and to decide what equity requires here, and then make it so by mandating the trustee's performance. So the equitable right holder lacks a kind of a suum, something that is, in a sense, hers to decide when she has a right. She has a right. It is something courts can give effect to, but she lacks standing to decide any question substantively about equity would have done. And what's more, is lacking that standing to decide the first order question, she actually doesn't fully have standing to decide how courts enforce it either. Courts retained the discretion to decide, no, we're not going to get involved here. But also, she lacks standing to decide entirely that equity will not be done. Courts will have and retain inherent jurisdiction to do equity, even in cases where the right holder has already said, I waive all my equitable rights. You cannot waive your rights in equity. A court of equity retains the inherent discretion to override all such prior attempts to waive your rights and will just require that equity be done. Why? Because it's not a matter for the right holder to decide. Okay, so there we have an example of right without, as Kant put it, coercion, as I would put it, without standing. And I guess one upshot is, standing is not a perfect filter on what counts as a right, but it does make us think a little more about the nature of rights and whether we want to classify rights a little bit differently. Where I come out on this is equitable rights are like individualized public rights, our rights to use the park, right? Or our rights to use roads. And they have a feature, in a sense, the same kind of, structure as those individualized public rights for reasons I elaborate more on in the paper. But I think what we have seen here is that the overall picture, that standing to sue or to enforce our rights is something we just take for granted in the very nature of rights. I raise some questions about that because we can't assume the justification for that standing. We need to establish it. It doesn't adhere in the nature of right. And secondly, the idea that standing is this concept that organizes our whole account of private rights is also something I think we need to look a little more closely at, and which I've tried to challenge in this talk. It doesn't explain the importance of what Kant called ambiguous rights or equitable rights, which I think of as very important complements to private law and private law theory, and serve this really important function of ensuring that people do not use their legal rights in a way that undermines the integrity of the Rechtsstaat itself, okay, that use it in ways that pull private law away from its core commitment to the idea of justice. Okay, well, thank you very much for your attention, and I look forward to your questions.